Hello, I'm Gary Lichtenstein from University of Pennsylvania, professor of medicine and the vice chief of gastroenterology. And with me today, I'm pleased to be sharing the stage with Dr. Neil Nandy. And please introduce yourself, Dr. Nandy.
Hi, Yang. My name is Neil Nandy. I'm an associate professor of clinical medicine at Perelman Center of Medicine at UPenn.
And today, in support of patient care, this activity has been implemented for CME, HMP education, and it's jointly accredited by the Council for Continuing Medical Education, the ACCME, and the ACPE and the ANCE. The program itself will be on Twitter, so you can follow us on Twitter. It's at CME Outfitters for the upcoming CME CE. Opportunities, healthcare news, and more. And the program itself is such that we have several learning objectives. One, to incorporate comprehensive tests for iron deficiency in patients with IBD based on principles of iron deficiency pathophysiology, which we will review, and iron deficiency in patients with IBD. Secondly, we'll evaluate the distinctions amongst IV iron products that are available, including current emerging clinical trial data on safety, efficacy, adverse events, and hypersensitivity for patients with IBD. And also we'll assess the use of IV iron in the pediatric IBD setting, which is something that not all products are appropriate to use and have regulatory approval in that scenario. And the last learning objective will be to develop patient-centered care plans with the use of shared decision-making with patients who have iron deficiency and inflammatory bowel disease, factoring in individual patient preferences, as well characteristics to optimize adherence and outcomes. So it's a full program Dr. Nandy feels are terrific objectives with truly clinically relevant focus today. We'll start with an audience response question. How confident do you feel in your ability to identify a patient with IBD in need of iron treatment for iron deficiency or iron deficiency anemia? A, not confident at all. B, somewhat confident. C, confident. D, extremely confident. Please select your best answer, and we'll review this in the future and discuss the findings. At this point, we're going to now start, and we will focus on, if we could back up, and talk about anemia and IBD. Dr. Nandy?
Thank you very much, Gary. All right, gang, well, welcome. Thanks for joining us tonight and taking a break from DDW. I know it's been a long and lengthy day, but hopefully you're getting some good nutrition, and part of that nutrition is stocked full of iron. And so hopefully you're repleting your iron stores as we speak. Now, anemia is common. I actually love speaking about iron deficiency. It's fun to review the pathophys, but let's talk about why we're talking about it in the first place. Now, anemia is a bread and butter consult in the world of gastroenterology, right? We see iron deficiency anemia consults in the hospital, regularly in the outpatient clinic. But in inflammatory bowel disease, I want you to reshape and rethink that iron deficiency and anemia are actually extraintestinal manifestations of inflammatory bowel disease. Usually we think of oral aphthous ulcers, uveitis, erythema nodosum, the inflammatory arthralgia. Those are the ones that oftentimes correlate or parallel disease activity. But anemia is an extraintestinal manifestation and very prevalent. It can occur in 16 to 70% of our patients with inflammatory bowel disease actually have iron deficiency. When you look at the charts on the right hand, you actually see that it's prevalent across all age groups, children in particular, adolescents and adults. So enough prevalence that we should be looking for it, and when we see it, doing something about it. Why does it matter? Look at the hospitalization status in that bottom right. Hospitalized patients are more likely to have iron deficiency. Perhaps not a surprise, but it's also a predictor, as we'll show in later slides. Of course, you're very familiar with the symptoms of iron deficiency anemia: shortness of breath, fatigue, dizziness, headache. But of course, there's also the other things, like neurocognitive things, irritability, insomnia, anorexia, and even pica. And yes, pica can take shape in many, many different ways, not just eating ice chips, but also soil. I even had a patient eating, believe it or not, clay pots. She'd go to Home Depot, get clay pots on sale, break them up and put them in her purse, and she'd snack on them all day. So interesting types of manifestations of pica. So iron deficiency is prevalent in Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. On the left, you have Crohn's disease, and on the right, ulcerative colitis. Below that, they've stratified that, whether those patients had anemia or not. Now, here's where it gets interesting. The third column. In those who were anemic, you'll see that of Crohn's patients in the bottom left, over 98% actually had iron deficiency. And if you look at the Crohn's patients who were not anemic, 45% actually had iron deficiency. So you can have both iron deficiency and iron deficiency anemia. So this is even without a low hemoglobin, you have to recognize that iron stores may be impaired. And the same is true in ulcerative colitis. Whether you have anemia or not anemia, you're still going to find a significant portion of patients who are going to present with iron deficiency. So how do we define iron deficiency? Well, the work has been done. The World Health Organization has standardized criteria, little ranges here, for what's mild, moderate, and severe. Now, for many of you are adult practitioners, there's also pediatric ranges, but if you look at these adult numbers in the bottom three rows, males and females, that middle column, it says mild anemia. This is how I try to, moderate anemia. This is how I try to remember things. 8 to 11, approximately, 8 to 10.9, 8 to 11 is moderate. So below 8 is severe, 11 and above is mild. That's basically how I try to keep a minimum of it. Severe anemia, though, in women can be as low as 7 in pregnancy. But remember, pregnancy, it's normal to have anemia of pregnancy due to the greater volume of distribution. So let's talk about normal iron homeostasis and what exactly happens. Well, right now, you're eating, you're ingesting, and on your plates, hopefully, in addition to your protein, you've got some green leafy greens chock full of some iron in there. Perhaps your protein has some iron in it, and it's making contact with your duodenum. And the duodenum is extremely important, right? So in the upper left here, we have the duodenal enterocyte. And on there is expressing a receptor called ferroportin. Now, how common is it that receptors actually sound exactly like what they do in medicine? Very uncommon, right? But this is perfect. Ferroportin, port in iron. So iron is imported from the gut across the luminal membrane in to the enterocyte, and then it's uptaked into the circulation. Our spleens, our macrophages that are circulating in the spleen, also have ferroportin. They express this. And so they uptake the iron from the blood, and they can store them temporarily for a time when they're needed later. So ferroportin is expressed in multiple places, but namely the enterocyte and also the macrophages. You'll note that there is the hepatocyte down there in the left. And we know that the liver can normally store iron. You'll see that there's a comment there that hepcidin is absent. And hepcidin is an inflammatory marker. It's raised up in inflammation. It is a strong regulator of iron homeostasis. But on this slide, it's absent. Now, when we have an inflammatory systemic sign of inflammation, hepcidin is actually increased by the liver. So there you see those little blue crescent circles are hepcidin. This is the inflammatory response, and you see that it actually blocks ferroportin both on the duodenal enterocyte and also on the macrophage. So now you can try to ingest as much iron as you want. However, it will not be absorbed. It will not be ported in to the enterocyte. So systemic inflammation causes hepcidin to upregulate, which inhibits ferroportin. Therefore, you don't absorb iron from the duodenum, and you don't release iron from your macrophage stores. So you become iron deficient. And this is a critical key pathway that you're going to continue to hear about throughout this talk. So iron deficiency anemia in inflammatory bowel disease is quite multifactorial. Sure, in ulcerative colitis, you've got significant rectal bleeding, overt blood losses. That makes sense, right? You're depleting your iron stores. But in Crohn's, where we rarely see bleeding is only really present in 6% of Crohn's patients. So we don't see bleeding there. Yes, they've got ulcers, but they're not always bleeding. It's the inflammatory state that's upregulating hepcidin and inhibiting ferroportins so you don't absorb iron from the gut or release it from your macrophages. So on the left, we have absolute iron deficiency. This is what we traditionally know. Your iron stores are depleted. Low iron stores, total iron available is completely inadequate. And in IBD, of course, you're going to have chronic blood loss if you have ulcerative colitis. Or if you're not feeling well, of course, you're not going to be eating food during a flare, so you're lacking dietary iron. Then you have functional iron deficiency, where you have normal iron stores, but you have impaired mobilization of iron from those macrophages because of hepcidin. And there's a shared pathway here with the anemia of inflammation. Now, inflammatory state. IBD is an inflammatory state, but we see other inflammatory states in the world of GI, namely in the form of celiac disease, right? Villus atrophy. It's not just the atrophy, it's an inflammatory state that prevents it from absorbing the iron. And then also obesity. Yes, obesity. There is a marked elevation in obesity here in the United States and in other countries around the world. And obesity itself is actually an inflammatory state. The visceral adiposity actually generates the upregulation of pro-inflammatory cytokines and actually contributes to hepcidin being increased and possibly to the generation of inflammatory bowel disease itself. So please pay close attention to those obese patients who have IBD. So how do we interpret the iron studies? I'm going to show you two graphics that are going to help us break this down. On the top, you see the organs that generate or store the iron and mobilize iron for hematopoiesis, storage in the liver and release, bone marrow for synthesis, and macrophages also for release. Transferrin actually transports, right, bound iron. We can actually calculate iron transferrin saturation by taking the ratio of serum iron to the total iron binding capacity, and that will give us our saturation. If you look at this beautiful illustration, it visually emphasizes the differences between your iron stores, your transport of iron, and how that reflects whether you have iron depletion, absolute iron deficiency, or functional iron deficiency. So in the left-hand column, hot pink, we see normal storage of iron, normal transport, that's the normal state. In iron depletion, we see those iron reservoirs, that tank being depleted, and therefore we have a low sat. In functional iron deficiency, this is impaired mobile storage, this is anemia of inflammation, you have iron that is totally intact but cannot be mobilized. And that's why you have to pay close attention to not just the saturation, but also the ferritin level. So in times of inflammation, if you look at the top right or the bottom, all the way to the right, functional iron deficiency, you can tolerate in an inflammatory state a ferritin up to 100, and it can still suggest that you have iron deficiency. So there are consensus guidelines on how to manage anemia in IBD. And I'm going to state the ECHO 2023 consensus, and towards the end of our talk, we're actually going to talk about the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation here in the U.S., where they also have a CORIS IBD anemia pathway. So how do we manage IBD patients in terms of their blood count? How often do we check labs when it comes to anemia? Well, the stable, healthy patient doesn't need labs often, right? I joke that the number one cause of anemia in our patients is overphlebotomy, right? We're too eager for labs. They're very reassuring. But healthy patients don't need labs often, so once or twice a year is good. But a patient who's flaring, that patient might need labs more often, and especially the patient who has iron deficiency, a biomarker of the disease, an extraintestinal manifestation of the disease, might need it more often. So every 3 months in active disease. You're looking for a low sat, you're looking for a high ferritin, even up to 100, and levels between 30 and 100 usually reflect a combination of both true iron deficiency and anemia of chronic disease. So now that we've prepared that, we know how often to check labs and the flaring or the healthy patient, let's talk about how do we manage this patient? How do we manage their anemia? We're going to break this down from left to right on your slide. There are essentially three columns to this algorithm, this protocol. On the left is mild anemia, hemoglobin of 10 to 12, moderate in the middle, 8 to 10, and severe, less than 8. You're going to start to look at that individual's hemoglobin by gender and define what is normal and are they anemic. You're going to look at their saturation, of course, which you're trained to do, and then you're going to interpret their ferritin. Now, anemia, mild anemia on the left, with a CRP, which is a marker of inflammation that's elevated in up to 60% of our IBD patients. CRP can tell you if there's systemic inflammation or going on. It's an indirect marker of hepcidin, you can think, okay? But I want you to remember that about 40% of your patients may not generate a CRP during active disease. So it's not it's not specific to a colitis flare. So mild anemia, if the CRP is up, suggests inflammation, and oral iron supplementation for mild anemia isn't going to work because what did we say? Hepcidin is up, ferroportin is down. You're not going to be able to absorb luminal or dietary iron. So that patient might do well with intravenous supplementation. Now, if you have mild anemia and the CRP is not up, they're not flaring, oral iron may be an option. I want you to think about that for a second here. I just told you that oral iron might be an option in an IBD patient only if they're not having active disease. Much of the GI upset that we experience as patients when we take over-the-counter iron is very common. It's due to the Fenton reaction. Iron is very toxic. It releases a lot of reactive oxygen species in our gut, and that gives you the diarrhea, the nausea, the constipation that you feel. It can even, in case reports, cause IBD flare in the active patient with active disease. Therefore, the patient who has mild anemia, no inflammation, oral iron might be something you could possibly try. Now we'll go to the other extreme where you have severe anemia, the rightmost column, and that patient is likely going to be symptomatic. If they don't have symptoms, all right, you've got some time, but if they have symptomatic anemia and it's less than 8, maybe other risk factors such as cardiovascular disease, you might even consider a blood transfusion if necessary. But of course, we want to avoid blood transfusion, the development of antibodies or transfusion reactions over time, and the more blood transfusions an individual gets, the harder it is to type and cross their blood. In the middle here, you have the moderate anemia patients. And oftentimes you're going right to intravenous iron supplementation. Put it in their vein, be done with it, don't bother with oral. Of course, you want to do periodic assessments. And the time to assess is approximately 4 weeks after completing iron infusions. That's when you want to repeat the blood work and see did their iron stores and hemoglobin increase. So what did we review? We reviewed that initial testing in patients with symptoms of anemia certainly includes a proper blood panel. This means a CBC, ferritin, CRP, TSAT, and certainly a retic count. But hopefully with a retic count, you really know if that patient's exsanguinating or bleeding quickly or not, just by history and physical, I would hope. Then you want to reassess the response. You want to test, treat, and reassess by looking 4 weeks. As early as 4 weeks after an infusion, you should be able to see at least a 2 g/dL increase in their hemoglobin from baseline. That's amazing that the human body, if you give it enough iron, should replete. And your goal is to see complete normalization of these iron indices. And if you don't meet that, what do? We retreat. We escalate therapy. We retitrate the dose. Of course, you should also address the other concomitant causes. It's not just the inflammation in the gut. It's how they feel. What's their nutritional status as well? Next, I'm going to turn the mic over to Gary to talk about different treatment options when supplementing iron.
Thank you, Neil. So Neil took you through the basics of absorption and pathophysiology. And the big question is, how do you use it? How do you treat patients? And obviously the patient comes in and says, Doc, I think I'm anemic. So you can check that and evaluate. So we have two options when we think of this, oral iron and parenteral iron. And the question is, which one do you use? Well, each has a distinct advantage and a disadvantage. Iron's been around forever, and people have ingested iron. And when you have inactive disease, that's the appropriate time to contemplate oral iron. And once daily dosing of, for example, ferrous sulfate, and we'll go through the oral formulations, is all you need. BID, TID is out the window. There's now data to suggest even every other day is appropriate, but it's once daily at a maximum. The problem is it's good. It works. It's inexpensive. It's accessible. There's low risk of serious adverse events. And patients take it for years, but they often stop it when they get the adverse events. And you don't know they're stopping it until you get the next CBC. You find out the hemoglobin has not changed. There's no active disease. Oh, doc, I stopped it. I became constipated. I had abdominal pain. I had nausea. I had dyspepsia. And these are often side effects that we encounter in clinical practice. The contemplation of using a parenteral iron should then come in to say, hey, I should consider this because I know the patients are going to get it. It's going to be rapid. There's less adverse events when it comes to parenteral administration directly. And it's also not impacted by inflammation. So this is something we have to think of when we administer parenteral administration versus oral. The formulations we have been around for many years. Ferrous fumarate, ferrous gluconate, ferrous sulfate, polysaccharide iron, and ferric maltol. And I'll talk about that. This is a newer iron formulation. And I'll review a study that was recently published. It's a new preparation. It's a combination of ferric iron, the Fe plus 3, and maltol. And it's given orally. And patients with quiescent ulcerative colitis tolerated it better compared to placebo. And you look at the tolerability, it's quite good. And also, the increase in hemoglobin by 2 grams is considered a clinical response. We like to see at 4 weeks that that's the number that you achieve. And that should be your goal in clinical practice, to set aside and say, does it go up? Now, someone comes in GI bleeding, hemoglobin 6, you're going to transfuse them. But also, at the time you do a transfusion, they are iron deficient. Hemoglobin amount in transfusions is low. So you need to contemplate parenteral iron whenever transfusions come about. And that's one of the biggest mistakes I see in management. When people come in, they're not transfused, or they are transfused, and they get transfused, they don't get the parenteral iron subsequently. If we look at IV iron in a recent meta-analysis, it's a higher efficacy in achieving a hemoglobin increase of 2 grams. So this is something, again, you need to get there rapidly with speed. The parenteral iron is going to be the most effective way to get there. If it's something that you don't need that, they're not actively bleeding, they don't have any problems with regards to dyspepsia or upper GI-related symptoms, give them more oral iron. Follow them closely. You might do a hemoglobin at 2 weeks if you're concerned, as opposed to 4 weeks. But that's an appropriate management strategy when it comes to such. Adverse events are seen to be lower with parenteral iron. And there's different formulations. I'll review those directly. There are some adverse events you need to be wary of, but obviously this is something that is quite effective, clinically used a lot, and taken rather easily, as opposed to the older formulations, the ones you hear about with the anaphylaxis. And we'll talk about severe adverse event rates. So the advantages of parenteral iron are severalfold. It's more effective. You get the iron right in. You don't have to go through the enterocyte. It goes directly in the blood. It's a more rapid correction of the anemia. You need the anemia to come up faster. Someone has cardiovascular disease, angina. You don't wait for them to have a myocardial infarction. You want to get it up rapidly. You give them parenteral iron if they come in with severe anemia. You're able to administer high doses in single infusions, and that's compared to the older formulations. You couldn't do that. And we'll talk more about that, the, quote, third generation options that we have currently available. You can also administer during infusions, and we do that frequently. Someone comes in, has a need for infliximab or vedolizumab, and, you know, they're getting an infusion. We can give parenteral iron, and it saves a trip directly. It's like getting the COVID vaccine in one arm and the flu shot in the other, just to make sure you get them. We do that as a routine, and there is some data to support that. The other thing is there are disadvantages. The initial cost can be higher than oral iron. There's also a mandate for an IV infusion, but it's a temporary one, and some are 15-minute infusions, others are a little longer. There'll be rare side effects, allergic or infusion reactions one can see, so you need an EpiPen just to be safe in your endoscopy suite or in the office, just to be sure that nothing happens. But the rates, again, are very low, not like the dextran iron that we had seen years ago. And hypophosphatemia, which we'll touch upon as well. So what do we have for IV iron formulations? Iron dextran, that's the one that's been around forever. You used to have to give a test dose, and it's given. It is approved also for the pediatric population. And I'll touch upon those which are approved for pediatrics and those which are approved for adults only, because that's a difference when it comes to administration. Ferric gluconate. iron sucrose, 200-300 milligrams. So you need 5 infusions or so for that to get to a gram, approximately. You have ferrocarboxy maltose, which can be given in one single shot, 750 milligrams or 1,000. And these are things that are in office 15 minutes. Ferumoxytol, 500 milligrams, 510 milligrams. And remember with ferumoxytol, if you give that and you do an MRI, the liver may be iso-intense with the spleen. So you may think that a patient has iron deposition disease, hemochromatosis. That persists 6 to 9 months, and then it resolves. So once you stop using it, that goes away, and it's no longer an issue. And then ferric diisomaltose, which is the latest agent to gain regulatory approval, and it's 1,000 milligrams IV over 20 minutes. So ferumoxytol and ferric diisomaltose are not FDA approved for pediatric administration. The others are all approved. Ferrocarboxy maltose, age 1 year or older. Iron sucrose, age 2 years or older. 6 years or older for ferric gluconate, and greater than 4 months for iron dextran. So you have options for treating pediatric patients when needed and appropriate. The oral iron formulations are useful, but the IVs also have some adverse events. And these are labeled as well. Directly. So there's no such thing as a free lunch with any medication we give, including aspirin or Tylenol. But I think recognizing what these are and paying particular attention and recognizing the alternative, if a patient doesn't tolerate an IV, an oral iron formulation, then use parenteral. If a patient has had a severe anemia, that's not a case where you want to give oral iron, you want to give parenteral iron. If a patient comes in GI bleeding, and they're going to bleed more, you don't want to say, oh, let's give you oral iron. Your hemoglobin's 8. We'll just follow you and see. That's a time you consider parenteral iron. There's scenarios that are clinically relevant to contemplate use of parenteral iron. And when doing so, recognize these adverse events and keep in mind, could they be related to the actual infusion? So the next generation irons, which I talked about, the third generation, are ferrocarboxy maltose, ferumoxytol, and ferric diisomaltose. And you look at the adverse events, anaphylactic, anaphylactoid reactions, 0.1%, 0.2%, 0.3%. The old data for low molecular weight iron dextran, and that's not the high molecular weight iron dextran, that's off the market. But the low molecular weight is sixfold compared to ferrocarboxy maltose, 0.6%. So you're approaching numbers that are important to realize, and they can come about in practice. And patients, of course, don't want that, nor do you as a practitioner. If you're a gastroenterologist, an internist, a family practitioner, or a hematologist, or anyone who's treating that directly. They less frequently cause serious infusion reactions as well. And this is a nice publication that highlights that directly. So again, you can be prepared for this to occur, but it's very uncommon that it does occur, given the 0.1%, for example, with ferrocarboxy maltose. I mentioned hypophosphatemia, and that's something that's gained recent recognition. And there's a recent trial that looked at two formulations, ferric diisomaltose and ferric carboxy maltose, and it highlighted in this particular trial that ferric carboxy maltose was a higher rate of biochemical hypophosphatemia. The key question is, what's the clinical rate that you'd see in clinical practice? And does biochemical mean that you should measure it on everyone? And the current standard of practice is not to measure a phosphate level before or after, but if a patient has symptoms, then one could contemplate assessment of this. They also looked at the fatigue score. The FACIT fatigue is a prospective assessment of fatigue as is rated by patients. It's an NIH established scale. And if you look overall initially, they're very similar when you use these two agents, ferric carboxy maltose or ferric diisomaltose. And at the end, they come out being the same. So it's hard to make a difference for me observing this clinically and say there's a huge difference. And if you look at this by the decrease in phosphate, again, the error bars are substantially overlapping. So when we look at this directly, you say, what's the outcome you want? We talked about the increase in hemoglobin by 2 grams, and that's something you'd want to look at in clinical practice. You can measure that. You can get a CBC back the same day, the next day, and get the hemoglobin data. And if you look, is it going to be better if someone has a low hemoglobin or a higher hemoglobin? So looking at an example here in this particular study, hemoglobin less than 8, week 4, week 8 to 12, and then you have week 16 looking at this, they separated patients, hemoglobin less than 10 versus above 10. And if you look, the error bars are very similar, so it's effective at higher and lower baseline hemoglobin doses. So it doesn't really depend upon your overall baseline hemoglobin. In addition, if you look at the intensity of reported non-hematologic conditions that people have symptoms from, these are very commonly encountered in clinical practice. How many people here go to the office and see a patient and say to a patient, how are you feeling? Doc, I'm tired. I have fatigue. You roll your eyes back. You go into status and say, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And remember, iron deficiency is one of the many reasons people can have fatigue, but it's changeable. You could have a medication. You could have sleep disturbances. And remember, restless leg syndrome is a result often of iron deficiency. You correct the iron deficiency, the restless leg syndrome gets better. You can ask the patient's spouse, are they kicking their feet at night when they sleep? And, oh, yeah, doc, I noticed that. Well, that's restless leg syndrome. They don't sleep well. There's other things as well. Cognitive impairment is well described with iron deficiency. Dyspneon exertion, and one of the most common things I find with patients is you ask them when they're going upstairs or up hills, are they dyspneic? And the answer is yes. That's often a sign that they're iron deficient. They don't have to be iron deficient anemia, but just iron deficiency. And that's a very common scenario that I see in clinical practice almost on a daily basis because my patient populations, patients with IBD. Other things as well. The sleep disorders, the loss of hair is another thing. So that's something one can see. And then the loss of concentration and headaches. These are all side effects that come about when people have iron deficiency. If we look at treatment with ferric diisomaltose in patients with IBD and iron deficiency anemia, you can see the hemoglobin benefit, the ferritin benefit after treatment, and SIBDQ is a validated instrument for assessment of quality of life in patients with IBD. We like to see a level go up, which means a better quality of life, and this is exactly what happens. So it's not only a biochemical parameter, but it helps them feel better, and they get better quality of life overall. And I think anything we can do as practitioners, whether you're an APP, a nurse, a physician, these are things that we try to do. And that's why we go into practice, to really help patients feel better. The other thing we know that is the work productivity measures are looked at as well. And in this particular study, work productivity, the mental component and the physical component of that directly are improved as well. So these are highly significant and clinically important to say treatment, and this probably would translate not just to ferric diisomaltose, but I would think anyone you correct anemia in, and this is all I'm highlighting in, that it's a multi-system effect to have anemia, and it's often under-recognized in patients, and we often don't realize that some of these symptoms they may be having are not somatic complaints that are foundless, but they're founded on having true problems. And iron deficiency, you can have normal hemoglobin and still have iron deficiency and still have symptoms related to such. This is a systematic review, network meta-analysis comparing efficacy of iron formulations, and basically showed that ferric carboxymaltose was the most effective at the time. This is before ferric diisomaltose came out, IV formulation, followed by iron sucrose, and this showed benefit. The agents studied were ferric carboxymaltose, iron sucrose, the iron isomaltoside, and it did not include dextran, furmoxitol, or iron gluconate. pediatric population. Iron should be contemplated and used as well. The guidelines that came about, treatment of anemia in pediatric patients with IBD, and you'll have these slides in the future. So these are things that we've assimilated. You'll get these at the end once you get your assessment, so you'll have all these to refer to. Iron deficiency should be treated with iron supplementation, optimizing dietary intake. So things that are high in iron are fish, meats, things of the nature. And controlling disease activity. So in IBD, you control the disease activity, the iron uptake through the enterocyte, which is found in the duodenum and the proximal jejunum, will be permitted. It won't get stuck in the enterocyte. The transporting of the iron through the enterocyte into the blood will be allowed, as Neil elegantly aligned and showed us that this is something that comes about. And also, you can give other things for iron directly. You can use vitamin C. It makes the iron acidic. It then gets taken up easier in the duodenum with acidity. But beware, too much vitamin C in patients with Crohn's, for example, oxalate kidney stones is a higher risk. So you want to be careful with that directly. IV iron is ineffective or poorly tolerated in moderate to severe disease. When you have IV medications, you know you want to use it, but the oral iron would be something that is contemplated with active disease. And there's no specific IV formulation over another. The pediatric population we talked about. Monitor the response 2 to 4 weeks after you get the treatment. Monitor your hemoglobin and see, does it go up 2 grams? Increase hemoglobin levels of 1 gram in 2 weeks or 2 grams in 4 weeks is considered success. Then you've done a good job, and it's not going to go up faster, so you have the metric to follow. So let's look at pediatric population. Age 6 to 18, single-center, uncontrolled prospective study, ferrocarboxymaltose, 15 mg per kilogram single dose, and that's the pediatric dose that's used. This looked at directly the proportion of patients with iron deficiency or iron deficiency pre- and post-FCM infusions is outlined here. So iron deficiency on the left prior to the parenteral administration and on the right prior to directly. So iron deficiency is in the blue. Iron deficiency anemia is in the violet. And you can see the numbers go down from 44 to 15 and from 56 to 12%. So clearly beneficial in that patient population as it is in adults. So we try to personalize our care. We try to individualize what we do, and we do what's called shared decision making with patients as well. We talk to them. We say, what is it you want to try? How do you feel? Here's the data. Let's go through the data and the literature, and let's try to do what's best for you and tailor the specific therapy for you in general. The same as we do with biologic therapy. Someone comes in, they have active disease. If they don't like injection formulations, then we're going to talk to them about pills or other things, if it's medically appropriate and appropriate for the clinical scenario. So the things we have to do are consider patient resources and the ability to access treatment when choosing between a parenteral or an oral therapy. We have to coordinate IV administration with other IBD treatments. So you want to make sure that you don't have someone coming in who really can't come in because they have a job that doesn't let them out any more than they have to. And then consider the patient-specific circumstances. Disability, work-home life, you know, does this make an impact? If transportation's an issue, look at the number of infusions and give it together with a biologic when you're giving it. And this is something we do very routinely to enable patients the ability to function and not have to be concerned. So here's a study, same-day iron infusion with oral biologics, and you can see a large number of patients. Patients receiving same-day biologic, 129. Patients receiving biologic infusion on a different day, 45 overall. So you look at the numbers. Any infusion reaction, 5%, 7%, they're approximately similar. Anaphylaxis, dyspnea, flushing, lightheadedness, nausea, vomiting. So I think it's a treatment paradigm we should incorporate in clinical practice, if not being done already, to save patients the visits coming back And certainly, you want to improve the quality of care you give, and by making sure people are adherent to what they're supposed to be taking is one of the ways we can do so. So with that, I said a lot. Now we're going to try to put this into clinical practice and really engage a case. And I'll turn this back to Neil.
Thank you, Gary. That was great. That was a very comprehensive review. Yeah, give it up. That was amazing. That was a lot of data to actually have to review all the different complex iron infusions and the oral iron infusion therapy. So that was a lot of data, but it was so beautifully packaged. And again, like Dr. Lichtenstein said, you have access to these beautiful slides that you can refer to in the future. So next, we're going to talk about our patient case. And as we go into that case, I want you to come into a mindset of something different here. This is going to be an IBD case. It's going to be a flaring case. And it's going to have iron deficiency. And in general, what do we do when somebody may flare? Significantly, we may talk about short-term treatments bridging to a longer-term treatment. We may, unfortunately, necessary evil, use corticosteroids to subdue the inflammation to bridge them to a non-steroid-sparing therapy, right? So we call that bridge therapy historically. But it takes time for a treatment option to work. It takes time for that biologic or small molecule, whatever you may have it, to take weeks, days, weeks, months to work. But what if it doesn't? The patient is still stuck with the anemia. It is therefore upon us to manage and treat that. So as we go through this case, I want you to think about how you'd supplement them with iron. And now think of iron as part of your bridge, part of your therapy to get them through, help them feel better, function as you wait to see whether the IBD therapeutic option you've chosen is effective or not. Okay? All right. We're going to start with Sharla. Sharla is a wonderful 27-year-old lady. She has a 5-year history of left-sided ulcerative colitis. She's on treatment with mesalamine, 2.4 grams per day as her maintenance therapy. And now she's coming to you with 6 weeks of daily diarrhea, significant tenesmus. She thinks it's from having lactose intolerance, right? She doesn't describe any bleeding in her stools yet. Concerningly, she says that as she goes up the stairs, she's having some dyspnea on exertion. She can't sleep at night the last few months. And her spouse has told her, just like Gary said, you have some constant leg movement when she's asleep. Keeps kicking in bed. She's fatigued with her swimming and jogging so much so she doesn't want to exercise anymore. She went to her OB-GYN 2 months ago and was given iron sulfate because they presumed that because she's female, this might be due to menstrual losses. But of course, after taking this just even once a day, she starts to have nausea and constipation. So what do? We say, you know what? Lactose intolerance is common. Did you know that as we age, we get less lactase on our brush border, so we have secondary acquired lactase deficiency? It's quite common as you age. So we say, you know what? Go ahead and avoid lactose. Go and avoid dairy. A dairy holiday, if you will. That's the nicest way you can say it to a patient, right? Take a lactate or an enzyme supplement if you can. Stop the oral iron supplement and let me know how you do. She doesn't do well, so we pursue labs and stool tests. Of course, when anybody flares, especially with colitis, we want to rule out and superimpose infections, and we also want to gauge non-invasively the degree of inflammation. So we're going to check for C. diff. We're going to check for other infectious stool studies, oftentimes negative. We're going to do a stool count protectin, which is very sensitive for colonic disease as opposed to small bowel. And we're going to get some blood work, right? We want to know why she's so fatigued. Is she anemic? We want to characterize the anemia. So here are her labs. Hemoglobin, 12.1. We would call that not too bad, right? Mild at best, right? Her MCV is normal, but you'll note that her retic is also normal, but her actual iron indices reflect a low iron saturation. Her ferritin is 42, so slightly up in that mid-range between 30 and 100. Her calprotectin is 45, so normal, right? She didn't have blood in her stools. What's going on here? Notably, her stool studies are all negative. So what do? We can't put this together. She sounds like she's flaring, lack of blood. She has some iron deficiency. Stool studies are negative, we scope. And this is her colonoscopy. This is an image, and I'm going to go ahead and actually play a video here so that you can actually see what that looks like. And I think video speaks even more than pictures. And it's nice to have video, I think, to really characterize and show you what we're seeing. So Gary, how would you, if you had to look at this, how would you describe this colon? What Mayo endoscopic disease of severity would you give this colon?
So descriptively, this is classic. It's erythematous, granular, looks friable because you see the little areas there. It's continuous. It starts, it looks like at the anal verge and goes continuously in a circumferential fashion. And you see the little white spots, those are the little erosions. So this I would define as a Mayo 2.
So she has Mayo 2, moderately severe ulcerative colitis, and the mesalamine, which is indicated for mild UC, is not cutting it, right? She doesn't have an infection. This is disease evolution. This is disease state. Some patients' disease may evolve to more significant inflammation over time. So now we live in 2024, and it's great, right? We've never had more options in our armamentarium than ever before, right? We have anti-TNFs. Infliximab, adalimumab, golimumab are approved for ulcerative colitis. We have an IL-12/23, and we also have an IL-23 mirikizumab that is commercially approved right now. Then we also have anti-integrants, right? Not monoclonal antibody that blocks a cytokine, but blocks lymphocyte trafficking. That would be vedolizumab. And then we have novel agents, which are small molecules, are called small molecules because the biologics, a protein, is about 150,000 kilodaltons, whereas these small molecules are like 300 or 400 daltons, so you can actually absorb them through your gut. So we have S1Ps that prevent lymphocyte egress out of lymph nodes into the gut, and we also have JAK inhibitors, which prevent phosphorylation inside the mucous membrane that would otherwise generate inflammatory cytokines. So we have multiple different options here. I want to talk, we have a 27-year-old female with left-sided ulcerative colitis for a number of years, initially maintained on mesalamine 2.4 grams a day, now presents with a flare with moderately severe disease. Gary, what would take a crack at this? What would her options be here?
So you have 10 options here, 10 different medications, and I'll tell you what goes through my mind when I look at this. I think the first thing is talk to the patient. Ask them, do you have any preference, oral versus parenteral, directly? And, of course, that comes into play. And then, are you contemplating pregnancy? Because a woman of childbearing age, if that's the case, then that would take off the plate TOFA, UPA, ozanimod, and etrasimod, because we don't have good pregnancy data on those directly. So that leaves us with Veto, mirikizumab, ustekinumab, and the anti-TNFs. And then it would be important to question, are there extraintestinal manifestations? If you have certain ones, such as erythema nodosum, pyoderma, then certain ones work better. Is there axial arthropathy? Then that would favor an anti-TNF versus, say, others. You know, these are the questions that go through your mind. And then the old one that you have to think of is, does your insurance cover this? Because that's an important question that we ask and we try to go through, because there are certain things that have to be tried initially. Remember also the JAK inhibitors, they are not options because you need in the United States to fail an anti-TNF first as per the regulatory approval. So these are the options we have, and choose carefully. If you go and you take that as an initial option, and then let's say you want to go to another medication, once you try an anti-TNF going to another anti-TNF, the data doesn't really support that well. Going from an initial agent to a subsequent agent, the IL-23s, the ustekinumab, the P19 inhibitors, mirikizumab, which is the only agent we have, do work. The number needed to treat is the same. The same would apply with TOFA and UPA, the small molecules. Ozanimod and etrasimod, if you go initially from an anti-TNF to those, the data is not as good. So I think here you have the anti-TNFs used to ustekinumab, mirikizumab, and Veto.
I think those are really good options, and I think you laid out a couple of thought processes there. One, she's a young, fertile woman who may want to have children. We want to preserve that and not muck up her options by giving her some of the orals where we don't have that safety data. So the biologics are very safe. You talked about extraintestinal manifestations. I think that's really important. And then some other subtleties that you might, ask about are, needle phobia, how good is IV access, right? Many of these biologics are self-subcutaneous. Even vedolizumab and infliximab have become subcutaneous after receiving FDA approvals in the fall of 23. So we have a lot of different options, and it takes a conversation with the patient, what we call shared decision making. There's other things you might put on that, actually, which is the family and cultural lens, right? What are they culturally, ethnically, and family structures are going to accept as well and be adherent to? So now that we've decided a biologic, now we're going to go through the insurance process and see what's going to go. However, we still have to supplement the anemia. We don't want to leave this patient with poor healthcare-related quality of life because of anemia. So there are different ways to do this. You can actually look at the labels of these IV doses and go by label, and many of them are weight-based, as Gary had shown in some of our tables. Some are fixed doses of 1,000, for instance, as Durusa maltose, or 750 milligram doses up to 2 doses, such as ferric carboxy maltose. And others have flexibility, right, to 1 to 300 milligrams like iron sucrose. So you have a lot of different choices. If you like, you can use the Ganzoni equation. Many people don't use that in clinical practice, but the Ganzoni equation, you can just Google it on your phone, and it asks you what the patient's current hemoglobin is, what their target hemoglobin you'd like it to be, and their gender, and it gives you an estimation of how much iron you need to supplement. So you can use that to help guide how much iron you really need to get to your target. So the severity of the anemia dictates whether it's oral and the quality of disease, whether it's controlled or not, whether oral is an option. And if not, you focus on IV options. So in terms of selecting an iron product, we mentioned all these different formula that we have. And I won't read all this out. It's nice to have this handy comparison chart. I urge you to quantify the severity of the anemia, the mild, moderate, or severe. You can use the Ganzoni equation, if you like, in order to determine how much iron to supplement. And then you can go ahead and identify which of these iron formula you would like to provide the patient. Now, let's talk a little bit again about, once we screen and evaluate the patient, what is our algorithm? So the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation has a quality task force called CORIS. And they actually, several years ago, developed an iron deficiency anemia treatment pathway. So basically, you're going to assess their symptoms. You're going to give them studies to look at their blood counts and iron studies. You're going to recognize whether they have iron deficiency with or without anemia. And based on that, you're going to go ahead and initiate an evaluation by looking at the blood work. So on the left, we have significant inflammation where we have ferritins up to 100 with or a ferritin greater than 100 with a low transferrin sat. And you're going to replete them with IV iron or oral iron based on their degree of inflammation. On the right, you have a patient who has adequate iron stores. This is the patient with inflammation that doesn't need to mobilize them. This is a patient with ferritin more than 100 and a high transferrin sat. And then for those patients, you may treat the inflammation first, focus on the gut and IV. If you have a ferritin more than 800, you're considering iron overload over 1,000, maybe even hemochromatosis, but hopefully you would have picked up on that by now. Now, what is the intervention? For patients who have inadequate iron stores or have significant anemia of chronic inflammation, you're going to, again, look at their IBDS activity. Is oral iron going to exacerbate a flare? If they're complete remission, no active disease, mild anemia, then ferric maltol, which has data for supplementation in IBD patients, is a good option. Other types of over-the-counter formula, however, might cause some GI upset. Tolerance may not be great. If they have active IBD, then you're going to consider IV iron while you figure out what treatment option you're going to get to bridge them to remission. And if necessary, you can consider a hematology referral. But to be honest, much of this can be handled in our GI offices. We don't have to refer to another specialist. That's another copay, time off from work. Much of this can be handled in your infusion centers that you already work with. Of course, if they have adequate iron stores after doing your entire workup, you're going to look for other causes of iron deficiency, of anemia. This patient's MCV, notably, was pretty normal in the 80s. You might look at B12 deficiency or even folate deficiency. Sometimes when you have B12 deficiency, instead of being macrocytic, you can have iron deficiency. Instead of being microcytic, you kind of average out in the middle, and it looks normal, but you have both. Now, a Crohn's patient can be B12 deficient if they have ileal disease. Why would an ulcerative colitis patient be B12 deficient? Well, diet, of course. Many people who don't have inflammatory bowel disease actually have low B12 stores because the American diet is actually deplete of multiple resources of dietary B12. So many normal people have B12 deficiency, and you can be feeling ill, you can have a flare. not have good nutrition, you can be B12 then deficient. So you don't have to have B12 deficiency, doesn't mean Crohn's or ileal disease. So, follow-up. This is the most important thing. We're talking about detecting and diagnosing iron deficiency. We're talking about categorizing it mild, moderate, severe. And then once we intervene with a treatment option, we have to recheck. So we recommend rechecking in about 4 weeks. And if they have been completely repleted, hemoglobin increased to 2 grams per deciliter, and you've met your criteria, they're no longer anemic, wonderful. But then we would repeat again as early as 4 weeks later to make sure that they've actually maintained that hemoglobin, that the whole process is not continuing. Hopefully, in that amount of time that's passing, your biologic or small molecule therapy is inducing remission and they're getting better on their own. Now, if they're not repleting their iron stores or they're still anemic, you're going to go ahead and continue to give them supplementation of iron appropriately until you hit your mark. So this is the entire CORIS anemia pathway breakdown. This is in your slide handouts that you'll get to take home with you today. You can download them. It basically makes it very, very elegant. You want to take a good history, send off the right labs to make the diagnosis. You want to intervene with the right supplement, whether it's oral or IV. And then you want to repeat the labs to absolutely determine you hit your metric, that you hit your mark and you're successful. And in that time, hopefully the IBD therapeutic option that you've chosen has actually worked and kept the patient into a durable clinical and mucosal healing. All right. We're going to ask one more question here, which is the audience response. Now, after listening to our talk here, how confident do you feel in your ability to identify a patient with IBD in need of iron treatment for iron deficiency or iron deficiency anemia? Please take a moment to enter your responses. Very good. So, you guys were pretty confident, even more confident after. I'm glad to hear that. All right. Next, we have just one recap summary here. SMART goals, right? Specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. I love this abbreviation here. Utilize oral iron in those patients with inactive IBD. Interpret ferritin for the presence of iron deficiency requires understanding that a ferritin up to 45 may be consistent with quiescent IBD, and active IBD, ferritin being an acute phase reactant, up to 100. So it doesn't exclude iron deficiency if it's up to 100. And then always proactively reassess those patients for their iron deficiency 4 weeks after supplementation has concluded. All right, thank you so much for your attention. We're going to turn our time to some questions and answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil, for a terrific overview. Questions we can take from the audience, yes. And I'll repeat them afterwards so all people hear.
You mentioned that you give IV iron for patients with GI. Are you talking about GI in patients who have IVE or even otherwise? Any patient that comes with GI?
GI bleed due to an ulcer or angiodysplasia, any other cause, or it's specifically in patients with IBD that you're talking about.
So, excellent question. I'll repeat that for the audience just because the microphone came later. I had mentioned that we give parenteral iron for patients that need transfusion, and was that specific for IBD or anyone? And that applies to anyone. Because the amount of iron that's administered in a packed red blood cell transfusion is low. And one can assume that individuals would need iron stores to replenish the hemoglobin that they lose. So this is pretty conventional and pretty standard.
I'll add to that.
I think that's something new.
Yeah.
We've not been doing it. I think I'm going to have to change my practice after 31 years of practice.
Yeah, you know, and that was a great question, actually, in general. And we can do this in general in any GI bleed or any patient. Usually, right, you're supplementing, giving them the minimum amount of blood, right? If they have no cardiovascular disease concerns, 8 is a pretty good threshold. If they are coming below 7 or low and they have cardiovascular risk factor, you want to get them higher, right? But you want to minimize the number of blood transfusions in anybody. The average packed unit of 250 cc of a unit of blood has about 250 milligrams of blood. But you're not going to give them enough blood to get them to a hemoglobin of 14. So the rest you can make up as an outpatient with IV iron. And that's actually often missed, actually, and lost in translation post-discharge. So that's actually a quality metric when you have a GI bleed that hasn't been fully repleted in their hemoglobin. Make sure there's a follow-up plan that they get the rest of their deficit through IV iron as opposed to blood. If you have a recurrent GI bleeder, the more blood transfusions, the harder it is to cross the blood.
I think Neil meant to say 250 milligrams of iron, not
iron.
Of red cells.
Iron, sorry.
So think of it, the ferric carboxymaltose is 1,000 milligrams. So 250 milligrams is a small amount. And you lose significant hemoglobin enough to mandate transfusion, which is typically 7 grams or less. Where we contemplate that. If it's above 7 and it's someone with active bleeding, we might contemplate that. But in general, there's higher mortality if it's hemoglobin, say, 8, we used to do years ago. So excellent question, though.
It's an extension of the same question that he had. Can we extrapolate the same data? We see a lot of patients with cirrhosis and with MASH being a very common cause of cirrhosis now. Many of those patients don't have active bleeding, but I guess they have some mild ongoing bleeding that keeps them anemic. So do we keep them on iron constantly? Do we keep giving them iron infusion? Or what do we check to determine if they need constant iron infusions or tablets or whatever?
I think that's a good question. And the question is, in some of these patients with a metabolic, you know, MASH cirrhosis or MASH disease, whether they, if they're anemic, how often to give IV iron, how do we manage their iron stores. I think that's a tricky line. There's a chronic anemia of chronic inflammatory state there that may be contributing in part. I don't know that it's always bleeding necessarily. I don't think that's bleeding unless they're cirrhotic and, you know, very advanced and they're having obvious bleeding. It's usually not. It's usually more anemia of chronic inflammation, the hepcidin pathway. But you bring up a very challenging question, actually, which is how much is too much, right, IV? What's the threshold and goal? And I think that's where it's important for symptoms, right, and paying attention and making sure that ferritin doesn't go too high. But I would love to talk to you more after this about that. That's a great question.
And other scenarios are Gave syndrome, we might see this in, hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia where they have chronic oozing, radiation enteritis. These are very commonly seen scenarios. So at least every 6 months is the standard that at least I've incorporated, and perhaps every 3 months to check a CBC. When we monitor immune modulators or biologics, we do every 3 months as a routine. So because you never know what happens in a patient with IBD, and the same thing can happen with GI bleeding. So it's better to be on the safe side. 4 times a year just to go to a lab is not a lot to tell patients. And then it's, you know, a little extra work for you as a practitioner, but it's a safety issue. And it depends. The old saying is the punishment has to fit the crime. So it depends on the clinical scenario and the clinical situation you're dealing with. So we have a whole host of other questions here I'll go through. I have some patients who seem to think IV iron means that they will need it forever and seems to keep it wanting going on. Have you seen this in practice where you've given it forever?
No, unless the you know, extraordinary circumstances. I think that's like an education piece, and that's a you know, very good example of how a patient has a fear, right? If they've never had to get an IV and now they have to get IV iron, they may have that concern. So I think reassuring the patient, identifying the cause, explaining and illustrating the treatment plan, the long-term plan to correct the anemia, that's really important. And no, it's not common. Now, are there IBD patients, since we're both IBD specialists, who've had multiple rounds of IV iron due to refractory disease? That answer is yes. That doesn't mean it's lifetime. Now with all our different treatment options, we have better hopes and opportunities to go ahead and improve their lives with those drugs. In the most severest of cases, if you're having a patient who's having excessive IV iron transfusion requirements or even blood, then you might rethink your whole scheme and you might be thinking about colectomy for that patient, actually.
But it's those people that have the chronic GI blood loss with the angioectasia. You know, the patients that come in that have the LVADs. they chronically bleed, they ooze. These are common scenarios, sure. And there's very little one can do other than follow and treat, because myocardial ischemia is not a good thing to have in those clinical scenarios. And it all depends on the age of the patient as well. A 20-year-old may be more resilient than a 50 or 60 or 70-year-old when it comes to tolerating anemia. And if it's a chronic condition that comes down slowly versus acutely, that may be better compensated as well. But I think vigilant, careful approach with thoughtfulness as to when to do things with the plan is the best way to go. And you can modify that plan as you go along. But monitoring is important. And don't only check for low hemoglobins, check your iron saturation. That's an important component as well, because symptomatic iron deficiency is plaguing to the patient. It impairs their quality of life, and they certainly feel better when they have that remedied.
One thing that you reminded me of, Gary, you brought up a good point, which is in relation to this question that you asked about might there be a patient who might need longer-term IV iron? And the GI bleed, the angioectasia, you know, sometimes you're going to get an elderly patient who, how many times can you do an enteroscopy, an APC? All the time, right? And they've got COPD, emphysema, they've got all these illnesses. So sometimes if it's not life-threatening bleeding and anemia, you just fill up the tank. But you have to determine the patient's slope of descent, how often you check those blood, and proactively, you know, infuse them with IV iron. So that might be a less common scenario, but an important scenario where they might need it not so frequent.
So do you ever switch between IV formulations?
It really depends. You know, I try to, if I know a patient's tolerating one well, and if they need it again, I'll give them that one. Infusion reactions are incredibly uncommon. The only time that I will go with something else is if there's an insurance mandate, to be honest, that we can't for some reason appeal. Now, if a patient has had an infusion reaction or some type of intolerance to one IV, obviously we're all going to document that, right? We're going to document that well and avoid that one and submit that to insurance for an alternate route.
And another scenario might be if they're, say, on iron sucrose. And that's five times, you know, they have to come in, get infusions, and their work doesn't permit them to continually come in. Then you might switch to one of the third-generation agents. And that would be one or two infusions done with, and you replenish total iron stores. So that would be a clinical scenario where I would contemplate that. Or if they had an allergic reaction to one, it doesn't cross-react to the other, because you can't be allergic to the iron. It's the carbohydrates surrounding it that's the agent, per se, that differentiates, you know, the diisomaltose from FC, ferrocarboxymaltose, from the ferumoxytol. They all have the iron, and it's not the iron itself, but it's the capsule surrounding it, the carbohydrate moiety. So if you're allergic to one, you're not necessarily allergic to another. Just like you get infliximab, you can tolerate adalimumab. It's not a cross-reaction. You have a little higher reaction rate with the biologics, but not necessarily with the iron products. So this is something where if they have an adverse event to one, you might contemplate another. If they're thinking of having iron overload, then I would get them off the ferumoxytol, because that's something that does concentrate in the spleen and looks like hemochromatosis. So you can get genetic testing and see do they have it, a heterozygote or a homozygote mutation. But again, those are clinical scenarios at least that come to mind where one might contemplate that.
I was going to say, Gary, you know, these are good detailed questions. I love the detail for the scenarios that everyone may not encounter. But the amount of iron, right, if you have already repleted. So there's studies that have looked at iron deficiency anemia all cause from celiac, from obesity, from GI bleed, from whatever it might be, and menstrual losses. And on average, and this is a paper that I'm referencing, the average deficit, as calculated by Ganzoni, was about 1,500 milligrams, up and down. And that's you know, kind of where ferrocarboxymaltose got their 750 times 2. But not everyone needs all of that, right? So you can give half, or you might, if they need just a little bit less, you might even use iron sucrose. So that's a subtlety. You know, usually you're seeing the anemia at its nadir, and so you're probably going to replete them with the maximum amount, the least number of infusions possible. That's my style. But if you have to fine-tune, I guess in that scenario, you might use an iron sucrose or some other lower dose formula to get them up without overloading them.
And also it depends what insurance permits, as you said.
Yeah, because insurance.
You may want to give them something, and then the cost out of pocket may be somewhat high. So, you know, we always talk what's appropriate. As with the biologics we do, with the iron formulations, we communicate with insurance companies, and once we educate them as to why one agent might be appropriate, oftentimes they will say it's acceptable.
Yeah.
So it depends on what's on your formulary locally as well. Other questions have come up. Is there data on ferrocarboxymaltose use with other causes of anemia, such as heart failure?
Yes, actually there is an abundant amount of data for iron deficiency in heart failure. CHF is another inflammatory state. There is a couple of studies that have looked at iron supplementation. So iron deficiency in CHF was actually demonstrated to be a prognostic marker for increased mortality. Imagine that, right? And we saw that in UC, we saw that, you know, it was a marker for hospitalization, right? So a marker of poor outcome, but mortality doesn't get more serious than that. So iron supplementation may improve outcomes in CHF, so it's an important marker to look at.
Can you co-administer iron, parenteral iron, with small molecules?
Yes, you can. Yes, there's no contraindication there.
I would agree.
Good question, though. Yeah. You never know when there might be an interaction, right? But yes, you can.
Let's see. How do you position the IV iron formulations in patients with anemia?
Yeah, I think we kind of covered that, right? I mean, you're going to look at the deficit, how much you need to supplement, and that's going to easily tell you which formula you're going to pick based on their dosing. And then the insurance layer is a practical hand.
And what questions do you ask patients when discussing iron deficiency in the office? What are the things you look for? Your review of systems, if you would.
In terms of just characterizing it, yeah, review of systems. I ask about cardiopulmonary compromise, lightheadedness, orthostatic changes, shortness of breath, chest pain, pressure, palpitations. Are they pallorous? That's actually something, a sign that I'm looking for. You can obviously look at cap refill for how good that might be. It has to be very slow, and you'd be pretty anemic at that point if it was slow and have a poor ejection fraction even. You can also look for subtle things, too. You mentioned hair loss, actually. Hair loss is a very, very common finding in iron deficiency, very common in our IBD patients. It's not just B-complex vitamins. Although you can, on physical exam, study the tongue, just like they've always done in Eastern medicine, look at the tongue, open the mouth, and that beefy red glossitis is not indicative or specific to a specific nutrient, but commonly B-complex or glossitis or even iron. You can even look in very, very severe, prolonged states of malnourishment and iron deficiency. You can look at the nail beds, and you'll see that the nails become very flat. Almost, they have like little rivets or curves to it. That is very advanced iron deficiency in my experience. And then you can also, on review systems, ask many of the things that we talked about before, insomnia, restless leg, neurocognitive, pica, those types of things.
So one of the board's questions that you might get on the long-term extension or otherwise is coilonychia. That's spooning of the nails,
yeah,
that you see in long-term severe iron deficiency, which I've seen perhaps in two or three cases in my 37 years or so in GI. So it's something, it's not common, but it's one of those things you may see,
yeah,
you know, directly. When would you not give oral iron up front to a patient?
I wouldn't give oral iron up front in someone with severe anemia. It is pointless, and I don't like to be pointless. I like to be effective in my treatment. So if anemia is severe, oral is unlikely to make up the deficit. They've actually done that study. You have significant anemia, you give IV versus oral iron, and then you look at iron indices over time, and you see that the iron deficiency in the oral iron patient keeps getting worse and worse and worse. But the IV iron patient obviously jumps up quick. And then, of course, someone who's been intolerant to oral iron, I'll ask them, have you been on oral iron before? What have you taken? Right? What's in your supplement? Does it cause you intolerance, right? And if it does, I'll avoid there too.
I agree. Any ethnicity background differences that more any race that is more prone to get iron deficiency than others, per se?
You know, you can say that if someone has frequent sickling, sickle cell, that might be something, you know, that you might consider. But that's usually you're working hand in hand with a hematologist, and they're identifying that upfront as an issue. And in fact, using IV iron proactively to minimize the amount of blood transfusions that they're already getting because of their crises. You have other patients who have thalassemias where you can see an anemia, and those patients might actually inappropriately be supplemented oral iron for something that, you know, that's just their normal hemoglobin. On those patients, you check a hemoglobin electrophoresis as part of your workup if your first-line iron workup didn't show any deficiency. So, yeah, anybody, don't know if there's anybody else that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Chronic kidney disease. Oh, I see. Yeah, I think the question I heard was ethnicity, right?
Ethnicity. But yeah. Other disease states, that's a great point with iron deficiency. Erythropoietin production is decreased in people with chronic anemia due to renal disease. EPO being made in the kidney. In fact, the JAK inhibitors inhibit EPO. So anemia is more common in some of the JAK inhibitors when it comes to medical therapy, and it's theoretically potential that you could see a higher rate of anemia in some, though it hasn't been carefully examined in any of the trials. You know, you have JAK 1, 2, 3, and TYK2, and TYK2 doesn't inhibit EPO, whereas all the JAKs do. Some of the JAKs do directly when you inhibit them. So it's of interest, but clearly people with chronic renal disease, we see iron deficiency without having any overt GI bleeding, if you would. So it's something to contemplate. You can order EPO levels. We didn't get into the complexity of ordering EPO levels and going in, but that's a whole other lecture. That's a good question. So I'll repeat it so people in the that are distant can hear. So when people come in, they can get recurrent infusions of parenteral iron. When do you worry about iron overload? And I guess when is something too much? And how do you gauge when and how to treat that? And I'll ask Neil to answer, and then I'll certainly.
Yeah, I mean, if you're seeing, first you're going to look at the frequency of their IV iron infusions. You're going to be paying attention to that ferritin and seeing if you're creating overload there. In our IBD patients, since, you know, that is my main focus, when we get MREs on some of our IBD patients, particularly with Crohn's, obviously, you can actually commonly look for iron overload on your MR scans. And so your radiologist, if they haven't commented on it, they usually do. If not, and you're worried about that, you can reread it with your radiologist and look at that score. So there are different ways, but you're paying attention to ferritin, frequency of infusions, to place them at risk for overload, and you can also do MR.
And the MR, you look for the spleen being iso-intense to the liver, and that's what you're looking at. So when they look the same, then that's consistent with iron deposition disease or iron overload disease. And it doesn't differentiate hemochromatosis from hemosiderosis. But again, that's based on the number of transfusions and the clinical presentation. But great question, because these are clinically relevant.
Excellent questions.
Yeah, okay. Vitamin C, when do you use it in addition to oral iron?
In oral iron, honestly, I do tell my patients to eat green leafy vegetables and whatever they have, a little citrus. So I don't have them buy a separate vitamin C supplement. A little fresh squeeze, a little spritz of lemon and lime on their salad or their protein goes a long way. It's bright in flavor. It's enough daily. It's the consistency of taking the vitamin C or having some citrus in their diet that will help. But I don't overemphasize a supplement on top of what they're taking.
It's the ferrous versus the ferric formulation that gets absorbed better in the duodenum. and hence and the proximal jejunum, and hence the acidification that is something that's done as a routine to increase the efficiency of absorption. And there's been data to show that that's helpful with oral formulations, not parenteral.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing about through scintillation studies they've done, when you take something like an oral tablet, anywhere from 70 to 90% of that is not going to get absorbed in the duodenum because it's just motility. It's just going to go right by and jettison out. So there's a limited capacity for absorption. You know, the average human intestine can only absorb up to 2 to 3 milligrams of iron a day, but the average losses per day just from GI epithelial friction and sloughing of those cells is also resulting in about 2 to 3 milligrams of iron in our stool. So net homeostasis. But when you supplement oral, your anemia has to be pretty mild for that over time to recapture and take effect, because the majority of it is literally going to be pooped out.
Do we have a question? Someone happened to come in late and asked to review the pathophysiology of iron absorption, just briefly.
So pathophys of iron homeostasis, when we our dietary iron comes is absorbed in our small intestine, duodenum to jejunum. Those duodenal cells have a receptor on them called ferroportin that import iron from the gut into the enterocyte for uptake into the bloodstream and circulation. But also, when we need iron, our macrophages actually have ferroportin to allow release from their internal stores of that iron for uptake into iron generation. So you have ferroportin on the duodenal membrane, you have ferroportin on these macrophages and other sites that are involved in homeostasis. So you need dietary intake, net in. You also have net out losses, either through gastrointestinal losses from daily bowel movements. You can also have additional, if you're female and having active menses, you can have additional menstrual losses, which may be compensated for or commonly not if you have heavy menses. So that's net iron in, net iron out. Now, what overlays this is the key concept of hepcidin, anemia of inflammation. When we have an inflammatory state, hepcidin, which is produced by the liver in states of inflammation due to cytokines, pro-inflammatory cytokines circulating, hepcidin blocks the ferroportin expression on the duodenal enterocyte and on the macrophage. So therefore, you can't absorb from the gut and you can't release from the macrophage. Therefore, you have a functional iron deficiency. So your iron stores may be good, but you cannot absorb or release. Your iron stores cannot be mobilized and transported.
So a question about IV iron when someone is septic in the hospital, is that something we should do?
No. that's a great question. And iron is inflammatory and has been shown to accelerate the septic cycle.
So it's based on old studies, and it's not well studied, but people are fearful because of the older studies. So it's something that, again, perhaps needs some rejuvenation and reassessment in the era that we're in. But the dogma and the teaching is not to do so. So any parting words that you have? We've had all the questions, unless more come in.
I'll say just to hone in the pathophys. When you have a patient with primary hemochromatosis and they get to the point of getting cirrhotic and needing a liver transplant, and they have a brand new liver, well, you haven't replaced that entire length of small bowel. And so that process of increased iron absorption persists and continues because of the ferroportin being intact. So just to kind of hone in that fact, that's the power of hepcidin and ferroportin play. I hope you all learned a lot. We hope that you took a lot away from this talk. We couldn't have been more detailed. And I hope that the resources that you can scan on this QR code here on your desk and at your tablets, you can take all this information home with you, review it, keep it for another day. The main point here is diagnose, assess, treat, and proactively recheck.
And I'd like to thank everyone for their participation. I'd like to remind you, go to CME Outfitters, visit the Gastroenterology Hub. There's free resources for education, to educate healthcare professionals and patients. And the URL is here. But to get CME CE credit for the activity, scan the appropriate QR code, log in, and create an account. And hopefully this has been educationally appropriate for you. We've tried to really bring up the salient features for clinical practice, and hopefully this helps your patients, yourselves, and wishing you a great evening and an enjoyable Digestive Disease Week. Thank you.
Thank you.